You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 14th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
The Northern Ireland Protocol is the biggest source of mistrust between us, and for all kinds of reasons, we need to fix this problem.
But can the problem be fixed? 2 years after the Northern Ireland Protocol was agreed, it's still being refined. We'll examine the latest round of wrangling. As ice caps melt with serious long-term consequences for the planet, the European Union has proposed a new strategy for the Arctic region, but they'll find stiff competition from both Russia and China. Then to the Middle East, where Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, has been meeting with his Israeli and Emirati counterparts in an effort to improve Israel's relationship with Arab states and strengthen the Abraham Accords. Could this replace a two-state solution, and how does Palestine feel? We'll hear about the Colin Powell School for Leadership, we'll rustle through the papers, have a round of business news, and as Monocle 24 celebrates 10 years, we'll revisit one of our favourite interviews with Martha Stewart.
If I were to have a last meal, which I am not planning on having anytime soon, by the way, I would definitely include a wonderful sushi by Weizhou-san of Karuma Sushi.
That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Taiwan's defence minister has said Taipei will not start a war with China, but that the self-ruled island is prepared to defend itself fully. Police in Norway say they are investigating whether the murder of five people with a bow and arrow was a terrorist act. And the World Health Organization says a newly formed advisory group on dangerous pathogens could be the last chance to determine the origins of COVID-19. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, 2 years since the most contentious part of the Brexit divorce deal, the Northern Ireland Protocol, was negotiated, revised proposals are now on the table. European Commission Vice President Maros Sefcovic presented a slight reworking of post-Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland to assuage the concerns of the UK government and Northern Ireland unionists. Well, joining me is the political journalist and author Terry Stiastony. Terry, the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson fought the 2019 election on a Get Brexit Done platform, and during the campaign he repeatedly claimed the withdrawal agreement he'd negotiated with Brussels, including the Northern Ireland Protocol, was a great deal, it was oven ready. But now his ex-advisor Dominic Cummings has said the plan for the protocol had always been to ditch the bits we didn't like, in quotes, after winning power. So did the UK ever have a workable plan?
Well, it's very interesting looking at, you know, there's this speech by the cabinet minister sort of in charge of these Brexit negotiations, Lord Frost. He went to Lisbon to talk, make sort of big grand statements about the future role of Britain. And he sort of seemed quite outraged. He said, "We are being asked to run a full scale external boundary of the EU through the centre of our country." And you kind of think, well, that is what you negotiated. And he said, you know, the protocol was drawn up in extreme haste at a time of great uncertainty. And you think, well, yes, we did know that, and we did know that there were going to be problems with this. But I think sort of what we're seeing here is a bit of bluster on both sides, as actually the EU and the UK are moving slightly closer together on quite a lot of these issues. Like when it comes to the actual concrete discussions about how to make this protocol work better, I think the two sides are less far apart than they were.
But I wonder if they can be trusted. I mean, Cummings remarked prompted Leo Varadkar, Ireland's deputy PM, to warn governments doing trade deals with the UK that it's a nation that doesn't necessarily keep its word. you know, can Boris Johnson's administration be trusted to stick to any new rules?
Well, this is the trouble yesterday. So Dominic Cummings yesterday was doing long sort of screeds of tweets exactly all about, partly blaming the Prime Minister, who he said didn't really understand what he had signed up to, and in any case was liable to sort of change his direction at any time. He's constantly comparing the Prime Minister to a sort of a wonky shopping trolley. And then in one of the tweets he said, newsflash, cheating foreigners is a core part of the job. Now, if you're David Frost, who in his speech said, we are constantly faced with generalised accusations that we can't be trusted and are not a reasonable international actor, this is not necessarily what you want somebody to say out loud, because he has to now, at the end of this week, go into another series of more substantial talks with the EU. And Maroš Šefčovič is saying that he hopes to have an outline agreement possibly within 3 weeks, possibly by the new year. So you probably don't really want somebody saying the quiet part out loud, which is, you know, that you are not necessarily negotiating in good faith when you still have to go in and continue these discussions. But it does seem to be that there are certain areas where they might give, you know, where the EU has given some ground, where the UK might give some ground. So we're talking about less documentation, for instance, for food products going into Northern Ireland, possibly agreement on things like medicine, possibly agreement on importing chilled meats and plants and so forth. Still some big sticking points, though. For instance, the role of the European Court of Justice, is this going to be the ultimate thing that decides disputes between the UK and the EU? Now, Britain's saying we still don't want that. We don't want the ECJ, you know, deciding things for us. Now, there's now possibly some prospect of some other kind of arbitration or mechanism that goes between the two. And there's still a sticking point on things like moving pets across borders.
So, I mean, there was a meeting between all 27 European ambassadors to sign off on revised proposals. And we're told that it was highly contentious. Do we know what areas cause particular concern?
Well, I think the areas where they have to work something out is particularly this thing about the role of the European Court of Justice. So the EU has said there is no single market without the role of the European Court of Justice to arbitrate over any disputes. But there seem to be suggestions that they could bring in some kind of another layer, if you like, before a dispute gets so bad that it has to go to the European Court of Justice. Many people on the British Brexit side are saying, well, you know, the point of leaving the EU was that we don't have to abide by these institutions making decisions for us. But there do seem to be also more ideas about, you know, ways of talking to people in Northern Ireland about what the problems are before the problems become more severe. But there seems to be, like, at the moment, less talk about red lines, and looking at Lord Frost's speech in Lisbon, much less talk about this idea of invoking Article 16, so sort of unilaterally breaking the protocol. He did mention that, but he mentioned it sort of fairly low down the page in his speech, and it wasn't something that was really kind of front and centre.
So what's the British reaction been to the EU proposals?
Well, they are saying that the government's saying they're ready for these next stage of intensive talks. The proposals seem to be widely believed to be more wide-ranging than the UK government had expected them to be. So they seem, I think, fairly pleased by this. Obviously, there is a certain amount of, you know, well, everybody saying how enormously difficult it is going to be. But the way of negotiations like this is often that, you know, that's the starting point of the two sides. And then once they get into rooms and once, you know, they sort of these negotiations drag on, that there possibly could be something where they can agree common ground.
And Northern Ireland, has there been any reaction from there?
Well, again, you know, so the DUP, the Democratic Union, is still saying, you know, this is far short of the fundamental change that they needed. They are still not happy about the application of the Northern Ireland Protocol and how it's been working. But then in the Republic, the Taoiseach there was saying, you know, well, there is an obvious way forward now. And, you know, there has been showing some imagination and innovation. So, you know, again, I think a lot of this is, you know, these are people making protests, or in the Republic's case saying, you know, OK, this is fine. We can work with this. But I think there is some space here to you know, to allow people to come closer together.
I mean, many analysts are saying that this growing dispute over the movement of goods into Northern Ireland could possibly derail future relations between the EU and the UK. Do you think that's the case?
I think, given what Maroš Šefčovič said yesterday, they do seem to have agreed to have a lot less paperwork, a lot less bureaucracy, particularly on moving food, for instance. So, you know, at the moment, if you are bringing a lorry load of goods across into Northern Ireland, you would have to sort of have separate paperwork for each kind of thing that you're bringing in. They're basically saying, OK, now, if you've got one big truckload, here's the paperwork for one big truckload. You just do that, and that is more simple. There are still going to be problems. There are still going to be bumps. And I think one of the things that we have seen over recent months is actually Northern Ireland bringing a lot more food in from the Republic, because they're obviously the border is still open and has to be because of the Good Friday Agreement. And so actually the shift in patterns of trade and a shift in patterns of how we move things around. But then given that, you know, obviously more generally there are problems with supplies, you know, around Europe and in the UK. So, you know, maybe that disguises some of the problems that there are in Northern Ireland slightly at the minute.
You mentioned the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, is that at risk?
I think that is the one thing that nobody wants to put at risk. I mean, that, you know, obviously since this agreement has happened, we have seen a bit more political instability in Northern Ireland. But, you know, I think that was such a hard-won agreement. I think that people really would back away from anything that that puts that at risk.
Mm. So what happens next?
Well, what happens next is that Lord Frost and his European counterparts are due to meet later on in the week. There are sort of some provisional talks already starting about the shape of the deal. They've said they will talk intensively for the next 3 weeks. And then the Commission were saying yesterday that, you know, we need to try and put aside some of the red lines, some of the deadlines. And they're saying that they hope to go into the new year with some new agreements. So that seems to suggest that they are prepared to continue talking for longer than the 3 weeks. And then they hope by the end of the year to have some kind of a workable way of going forward.
Terry, thank you very much indeed. That was Terry Stiastny there. The European Union unveiled a new Arctic strategy yesterday with the aim of ensuring access to critical rare earth elements in the region and ending oil and gas explorations. Joining me is Suzanne Lynch, author of Politico's Brussels Playbook. Suzanne, thanks for coming on the show. Why is the Arctic region so critical?
Well, the Arctic region is somewhere on the edge of Europe, if you like. The Arctic Circle is something that's always been in the EU's sights through Greenland, which is right there in the Arctic Ocean. That's owned, if you like, by Denmark. The EU has a direct connection with it. But it's also part of the broader Arctic Circle, the countries that are members of this kind of sphere of influence, if you like. So in the last few years, there have been promises from the EU to update their Arctic strategy. In the last few weeks, we saw groups of MEPs visiting the area. They've been looking at the issue about climate change, but also the geopolitical tensions that are there and the interests of other countries like Russia, China, even the US. We all remember when Donald Trump joked that he was going to buy Greenland. They have all been eyeing opportunities in this area of the globe.
Mm. Well, let's look at the strategy that they're discussing, and starting with the moratorium on fossil exploration. What's the situation there?
Yeah, well, this is kind of an ambitious target to ban any new oil, gas and coal production in the Arctic Circle and making it illegal for other member states to purchase any hydrocarbons that come from those projects. So this is going to be quite a task. Russia in particular has quite a lot of interest in the area historically, but also specifically in terms of energy. And of course, the EU is very dependent on Russia for its energy. So how far it's going to be able to shape that is another matter. The other issue they're looking at, which is connected, is kind of encouraging green finance and green research. So things like the European Investment Bank. may help, you know, other banks invest in a green way, in green energy, for example, in the Arctic. Also things like research and development, encouraging research in through its EU research program, Horizon Europe, and trying to encourage that, that will, you know, develop projects that are more green and that will eventually be used in this region.
So the EU wants a foothold in Greenland. Is that achievable?
I think it is. It's always, as I said, had an interest there. Norway and Sweden and Finland are also technically part of the Arctic Circle, but they don't have direct access to the Arctic Ocean there. But it's got huge importance in terms of strategy. It's the largest island in the world. Greenland is about 80% covered with ice, but there's real concerns now about the pace of the ice melting in that and what it means. For example, Russia has put a lot of money and effort into this kind of northern route that makes it much quicker to get to the Arctic at certain times of the year when the ice is melted. So a melting ice cap there would have implications for those things like shipping routes. So the EU needs to be aware of what's going on in its backyard, if you like. And also the fact that it's got such an abundant natural resources, things like these rare minerals, iron ore, that other countries like the US, even India, believe it or not, had an Arctic strategy in the last few years. So I think the EU realises it needs to be at the table when decisions are being made about the strategic area.
But Greenland is not a member of the EU. I mean, is that problematic for the bloc?
Well, Greenland is owned by Denmark, so it's kind of a semi-autonomous territory within Denmark. So in that sense, the EU does have a kind of direct link. Now, what it is going to do is open an office in the capital of Greenland. So I think that is extremely significant. They're saying that, you know, they've always had a presence there, but they're now saying they're going to up their diplomatic presence there. And that is again, I think, following on from what happened with America. I mean, people did kind of laugh at the time when Donald Trump said about buying Greenland. But in fact, the US did up their investment there. They did open a new presence in Greenland. So I think the EU feels that it needs to increase its diplomatic presence there to have a role in this part of the world.
But I mean, there's so much strong competition, as you say, from China, from Russia, from the US. How much influence can the EU hope to have in terms of an overarching Arctic strategy?
I think you're right in that. I mean, I think the elephant in the room here is the geopolitical significance of Greenland. We have seen even China trying to get a foothold into Greenland. We have seen Russia increase kind of military drills and its military presence there. The US has had an air base there. So in terms of those aspects, which a lot of people would say are the most important relevance of Greenland, yes, the EU has limited capabilities in that, let's face it, when it comes to military foreign policy. So what they're trying to do instead is to really focus on the climate change aspect and say, look, this affects everyone and we have got a strategic and day-to-day interest here, and it is in our interest that it remains a sustainable and as well as peaceful place. So I think it's linking in it in, and the EU, to be fair, is very much leading when it comes to climate change. It's got its Green New Deal, and I think it's going to harness that to try and influence what's happening in the region through that climate change strategy more than anything else.
And will the Arctic region be represented at COP26?
I'm not sure about that one. I know COP26, a lot of countries, we know, for example, even Vladimir Putin, for example, has not confirmed if he's actually going to attend that yet. So that would be even the first step, if you like. So the EU obviously will, and it will come into play in terms of the EU representation there for it, at the very least.
Suzanne Lynch, thank you very much indeed. Now, still to come on the programme, we look at the situation in the Middle East, hear from retired US General and former Secretary of State Colin Powell, and on the occasion of Monocle 24's 10th birthday, we'll revisit one of our key interviews. Today, it's Martha Stewart.
If I were to have a last meal, which I am not planning on having anytime soon, by the way, I would definitely include a wonderful sushi by Weizhou-san of Karuma Sushi.
This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
The leaders of Israel, the UAE and Bahrain signed the Abraham Accords, agreements to normalise relations between Israel and Arab nations at the White House last September. The following month, Israel and Sudan announced that they too would normalise relations, and Morocco established diplomatic ties with Israel in December after US President Joe Biden won the American election. Yesterday, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken held a series of meetings to expand the agreement. Well, joining me down the line is Alison Kaplan-Sumar, a journalist for Haaretz. Alison, thanks for talking to us from Israel. Do we know what happened at Blinken's meetings yesterday?
Well, you know, we know that they discussed, obviously, how to expand the Abraham Accords in terms of intensifying ties and ways that the United States can encourage it. But they also discussed Iran a great deal. They discussed the failure to return to the nuclear deal and the runway. And, you know, we imagine that there were maybe some quiet conversations about whether there was going to be any alternatives to the diplomatic path. They were asked about that at the press conference. And Blinken said that all options are still on the table, which is code word for the fact that no one's ruling out a military intervention, although realistically, we wouldn't expect something like that, soon.
Do you think that the Abraham Accords are a substitute for a two-state solution, and has that been discussed?
Well, as conceived during the Trump administration, the Trump administration, you know, unprecedentedly said that we're not meant to be an honest broker between Israel and the Palestinians. They were, you know, adamantly pro-Israel, and this basically caused the Palestinians to boycott them. And the concept of the Abraham Accords was like, fine, if the Palestinians don't want to participate, that's no reason why Israel should not try to pursue peace with other Muslim nations with the encouragement of the United States. And to everyone's surprise, it succeeded in the Abraham Accords. And so it was conceived as sort of a diplomatic end run around the Palestinians. Now, the Biden administration has always paid sort of rhetorical lip service to supporting the Accords, because obviously it's peace between Israel and these Arab nations. But for the past months since coming into office, Biden has really not taken an active role in expanding them. And so this meeting sort of shows that there's sort of a newly renewed effort on the Biden administration's part to do so. And I think it's because they've taken the time to sort of cultivate ties with the Palestinians and signal to them that they are pushing forward with the two-state solution, so that going back to encouraging the Abraham Accords doesn't appear to be in a vacuum in the absence of pushing towards a two-state solution.
And how does Palestine feel about these meetings with, you know, Israel and the US and the Emiratis and so on?
I think, you know, obviously they're not going to admit it out loud, but I think they understand, you know, they were taken by surprise by the Abraham Accords, and they understand to a certain extent they missed the boat in leveraging the Palestinian cause in order to, you know, being part of the deal. And, you know, they're very much on the outside, though they don't regret, I don't think, you know, cooperating with the Trump administration. But I think they are seeing the Biden White House as an opportunity to sort of get into the game and get into the action. So I think that their attitude now is to participate more in what's going on between the U.S. And Israel and the Gulf states.
And how does Biden's approach differ from his predecessor, Trump?
Well, as I said, the Trump administration closed down the U.S. Consulate in Jerusalem, which was exclusively for the Palestinians, significantly cut funding for aid to the Palestinians. It was a real, you know, blatantly pro-Israel approach and trying to play hardball with the Palestinians, you know, saying that they were giving payments to people who committed terror acts and their families, etc. They played very much hardball with the Palestinians, as while they were cultivating this the Abraham Accords. And I think that the Biden administration is signaling and, you know, telling journalists, including that that they plan to do both, that they plan to try to encourage the Abraham Accords and move forward with the two-state solution. Just, you know, I have to note, many of the articles that were written about 1 year since the Abraham Accords pointed out that the Biden administration hadn't done much with them. And as things heat up on the political front in the United States, the Republicans are sort of pointing to it as another example of Biden's foreign policy failure, you know, together with Afghanistan. So I think that's kind of one of the reasons why Biden administration is now getting more active with doing something with the Abraham Accords and maybe trying to expand them to other countries.
And how has the change in Israeli leadership affected the situation?
Well, you know, we had this buddy, you know, brotherly relationship between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. And so their politics very much complemented each other in terms of pushing the Palestinians out of the picture. If Biden had come in and, you know, Biden had a lot of ill will towards Netanyahu with their long history through the Obama administration, it would have been much, much more difficult for Biden to make this kind of sort of diplomatic move. So, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, the Bennett government, I mean, maybe Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, who is actually in Washington, is more open to working with the Biden administration. But really, the big factor here now is the absence of Netanyahu in the picture. And that makes a lot of things possible. Mm.
Now, the U.S. has said that the three countries, that themselves, Israel and the UAE, will be setting up two working groups. And one will focus on religious coexistence and one will focus on water and energy issues. There are huge problems around both of those subjects, but particularly if we could just have a quick look at water and energy. What are the precise problems facing that region?
I mean, there's a huge problem, obviously, with climate change, with a lack of water everywhere, and there's and with energy. I mean, in terms of in Israel, there's now been this like circuitous route in order for Israel to provide electricity to Lebanon. Lebanon would not accept electricity directly from Israel. As we know, Lebanon's in terrible state and they have regular electronic shortages. And so there's now the circuitous route through Egypt and Jordan, through which Lebanon's receiving electricity. So I think that, you know, it's aimed at finding diplomatically acceptable ways for Israel to share water and electric resources with its neighbors, and you know, the carrot stick approach, showing, you know, a lot of the countries in the region the advantages to warming up its diplomatic relationship with Israel despite their historical opposition to it.
Alison, thank you very much indeed. That's Alison Kaplan-Sumer. And here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Taiwan's defense minister has said Taipei will not start a war with China, but will defend itself full on. The comments come a week after Taiwan said tensions with China are at their highest in more than 40 years. Beijing has increased military activity in the Taiwan Strait, with mounting international concern China could use force to bring the self-ruled island under its control. Police in Norway say five people have been killed and two more injured by a man using a bow and arrow. A 37-year-old man in the town of Kongsberg has been arrested, and police say they are investigating whether the attacks were an act of terrorism. The World Health Organization says a newly formed advisory group on dangerous pathogens could be the last chance to determine the origins of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. The WHO is urging China to provide data from early cases, which were first reported in the city of Wuhan in December 2019. China has repeatedly dismissed theories that the virus leaked from one of its laboratories. And today's Monocle Minute reports on talks in Japan to reintroduce Go to Travel, a campaign to subsidize local residents' transportation, hotels and tourism attractions in the country. You can read more at monocle.com/minute. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. General Colin Powell was the first black Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the history of the United States. Now 84 years old, the former general has mostly retired from public life, but he maintains his involvement in one particular passion, education. As schools and universities return to in-person classrooms this autumn, Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak joined the Orientation Week for the Colin Powell School for Civic and Global Leadership in Harlem, New York. He also spoke with Powell about the importance of education in lifting minorities like himself into roles of leadership. Over to you, Chris.
The students shuffle into the lecture hall with that mix of anticipation and nerves that we surely all remember on the first day of a new school. Except this one is a little different than most years, of course. The students are masked and they're asked to sit with one seat in between, given the ongoing risk of the pandemic. It's not the easiest way to get introduced to your future classmates, but still, sporadic conversations do get underway. Dean Andrew Rich gives the students some time to settle in before taking control of the class.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you? All right. So I'm Dean Rich. I am the dean of the Colin Powell School.
First off, Dean Rich has to explain the new rules.
So we're going to follow the protocols for COVID on campus, which is the...
And why there's wrapped sandwiches instead of pizza at the back of the class.
And we had to follow the COVID protocols on that too, which means everything is wrapped up tight, which is good from a safety standpoint.
Welcome to Orientation Week at the Colin Powell School for Civic and Global Leadership in Harlem, New York. Dean Rich's opening lines have no doubt been repeated in countless classrooms as students return to class this autumn. Part of the new normal of education these days. Dean Rich tells the class that it's okay to be nervous, and not just because of the pandemic. Many of the students listening are the first in their families to go to college, so there is some additional pressure or unfamiliarity. Much of what follows over the rest of this two-hour session with students focuses on things like mentorship and support. They play clips from former students talking about how to cope with struggle through the initial stages, why it's best to persevere and not drop out, and the facilities available to help you on campus.
Luckily, I arrived to a college that is so willing to help any student in need because they understand that everybody comes from different backgrounds.
I have my fair share of mental health issues and I went to the psychology department and they offered me therapy for free and that had a significant impact on my life.
The Colin Powell School is effectively the social sciences department of the City College of New York, or CCNY, which itself is the oldest of New York City's public universities and is based in Harlem. The school has a special mission, to focus on the underprivileged in New York and throughout the country, who wouldn't necessarily have a chance to go to college otherwise. About three quarters of the attendees each year are either minorities or immigrants. I'll let one of the students help me explain it.
I think this is definitely a school for social change. Like, if you know about the history of school, it basically started as a freedom school. And that's what this school has always been. Actually, that's one of the reasons I decided to go to this school, because I was looking at the demographics of the school and it was like one of the only schools where like people of color were the majority. And so I was like, all right, I feel like if I want to be a sociology major, this is where I should be, where I'm actually going to be connecting with people.
The school is named after General Colin Powell, a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the 1990s and later the U.S. Secretary of State under George W. Bush. General Powell is also a New Yorker, born in Harlem, and an alumnus of CCNY himself. And despite his illustrious career of service, it's clear that General Powell still remembers his roots.
I always remind myself that I'm a minority, and I'm the son of immigrants, who never would have dreamed of graduating from college. But it was clear to my mother and to my father, two Jamaicans, that by God, you're going to, whether you like it or not. And that's what I did. They expected it of me. And that's what we expect all the kids we have there. And they're doing well. Diversity is something we have to continue to work on. And much of the diversity now is caused by youngsters who have not gotten the education they need to compete in that diverse world. And so that's what CCNY and the Powell School is all about.
Like all universities around the world, the Colin Powell School has struggled to keep classes going in the last 18 months, Shifting everything online just isn't the same. And for many of the students attending Orientation Week, it's a relief just to be back on a campus. So much of what going to university means involves that human connection and networking opportunity. For those who started last year, they're meeting some of their fellow students in person for the first time.
Definitely better and like different because last year was fully online. I didn't have any in-person class, nothing hybrid either. So this is like my first time actually having a class on campus. So I'm super excited. I haven't been to one yet, so I'm waiting for Monday, but I already know it's going to be great. I can feel it. Just I'm so excited to be here.
I mean, I met some people like this guy.
Yeah.
Online on Discord. Like we form like study groups with like our classes.
Okay. Yeah.
That was pretty cool. But like, yeah, this is actually our first day meeting in person.
Yeah.
This is actually our first day meeting in person.
For many students of the Colin Powell School, the past 18 months has been doubly challenging. Many families faced additional financial hardships, from losing jobs or being frontline workers. For Dean Rich, the last year was about making sure those students with particular vulnerabilities did not fall through the cracks.
There's always going to be 200 or 300 who are these star students who find things on their own but or take advantage of everything we do to help them, right? One of the things we worry and work on a lot is the next 2,000 students, right? Making sure that everybody gets the full advantages of this. And I think that's where the pandemic has just been kind of devastating, honestly, but where we now have the chance to kind of make up ground.
Speaking to General Colin Powell, you get a sense of a few things. The first is his passion for the role of education when it comes to getting more minorities into leadership positions in the United States. And the second is the importance of role models, whether that's parents or teachers or role models like himself, who can push students to stick with it, even when times are tough. It's when instilling that sense of perseverance that he draws from his own background, not just his family upbringing, but his time in the military as well.
One good thing, both in my experience and their experience, is that it is owned by a former general in the United States Army, me. And so I communicated to them in a way that said, if you've got something in your mind, this is something you want to do, you've got to work for it, you've got to stick on it. It's what I had to do to get out of CCNY, and it's what I expect the students to do. We've made it clear to them that they are in a unique school, part of a unique university system, and I want you to put everything into it. We're not here to fool around. We're not here to drop out. I want you to do your very, very best. It's what I had to do when I was your age, and I was somehow in City College of New York with my C average, but somehow I got through City College of New York with my C average, to include going into the Army with my C average, but with A in ROTC, the military program, and I became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Secretary of State. And so it showed them what's possible if you stick with it. And so I really did some military education to my kids. And I call them my kids. I also call my soldiers my kids.
Colin Powell there and Monocle's Chris Chermak. Let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me in the studio is journalist and communications consultant Simon Brook. Good morning to you, Simon.
Good morning, Georgina.
Simon, Colin. I mean, we would Colin. Say Colin. But why is it Colin?
Because he's American and they pronounce everything wrong. Isn't that what it is? I don't know.
Oh, be careful.
Let's call the whole thing.
Listen, it's 75 years since Mussolini fell, and yet Italy appears to be going back to that place. Tell us what the Telegraph's saying on this.
Yeah, a worrying story here in the Telegraph, as you say. I mean, and this is about Italy, but I think it probably has ramifications for the rest of Europe. The paper reports that the spectre of fascism and anti-Semitism stalks Italy over the passports for vaccination, people who are vaccinated. So on Wednesday, the right candidate for mayor of Rome, Enrico Michetti, praised Italy praised Hitler and the Wehrmacht, and is a radio program that he hosts. And he is backed by the far right group, the Fratelli d'Italia, the Brothers of Italy, who have really regard themselves as the heir to Mussolini and Italy's fascist movement. They're doing well in the polls and could well be amazingly Italy's most popular party. So a lot of this hinges on the fact that from Friday, people will have to have a vaccine passport, a green pass. This is a certificate to show whether that they've been vaccinated or at least that they've been tested negative for COVID-19. So the state is requiring people to have this pass, and this is giving an opportunity for those on the extreme right to have to have demonstrations and really to cause an awful lot of trouble. So it's interesting, as I say, this is an Italian story, but I suppose the question is, will other far-right groups, extremists around Europe, look, and around the world indeed, look at this sort of, the kind of restrictions we might have to have, the regulations we might have to control COVID going forward, and will they use this as a way of stirring up unrest?
And one of the really worrying things I found from this story is that on another segment of the radio programme, Machetti said that the memory of the Holocaust has been kept alive only because Jews have immense political power and control the banks. I mean, that level of anti-Semitism, the fact that that kind of bat squeak of hatred against Jews is still very much there, is hugely worrying.
It is. It is absolutely terrifying, especially as we've seen in many countries increased attacks on Jewish people. So, as you say, the fact that somebody on a mainstream outlet with political clout can say something that exactly we would have thought, you know, we'd buried 70 years ago or something, the fact that this is coming back, and the fact that there are sort of parallels, as the piece points out, with almost exactly 100 years ago when Mussolini's black shirts began to seize control of the country. It's really frightening, and I think a real wake-up call for everybody who believes in democracy and equal rights.
Now, Joe Biden and his officials have announced ambitious offshore wind plans. What are those?
Yeah, I have to say, this is amazing. This is a massive project that's been recently unveiled, and it will, as you say, almost the entire coastline, as the Times reports, will be covered with offshore wind farms. The idea is that, that currently the US is the world's second largest carbon dioxide polluter after China, the Times reminds us, but Biden has pledged to slash America's fossil fuel emissions in half by 2030, which is amazing. I mean, it's what, you know, sort of 9 years' time, and that in half, I should say, compared to the 2005 levels. So this is a massive project, and certainly you've got to admire Biden's vision and energy. As I say, it is quite remarkable. I think the question is, and the Times sort of poses this question as well to some extent, given the problems already that the president's Build Back Better and infrastructure legislation is facing, even from his own side, people sort of balking at the huge cost or whatever, will he manage to get this through? And I think the other question actually that isn't mentioned here, but you know, he's heading for midterm elections next year, of course, and there's going to be a bit of NIMBYism. I suppose a lot of people won't like the idea of these huge wind farms are spoiling their view of the coast.
Absolutely. Now, here's a word I have not come across before. It's from the FT, and they are talking about profligacy.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll let you pronounce that one. what
is it?
Talking pronunciation. Well, that's a very good question, I have to say. The FT columnist Jemima Kelly examines a new book about identity after authenticity. And if I'm right in thinking, there's a difference between authenticity and sincerity, apparently. But anyway, the point is that people such as Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, have been very successful because they've mastered their own brands. So whether you're a politician or an ordinary individual like ourselves or whatever, there is a sort of distinction between our genuine selves, if you like, and the brand we we sort of put out there on social media and other places. And I think we all sort of, we've seen this, haven't we, with the emergence of social media. We've got these two personalities, and many people, you know, the real self, and then the sort of the fun-loving, wonderful, person out there on social media.
Or the work self. I find myself, I use it exclusively to go, this is what I'm doing work-wise.
Yes, absolutely. So there's the two sides of it. Yeah. So I think basically this is a rather detailed analytic analysis of that distinction, that dichotomy, and the fact, as I say, pointing out that some people do it very well, some politicians have sort of fake sincerity, if that makes sense, that even though they might tell untruths, it does seem to work very well with the electorate.
Mm. Are we looking at anyone in particular there?
Well, as I say, they mentioned Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, but yeah, you know, brand Georgina Goodwin. I mean, we all have to sort of create this brand, don't we, perhaps?
Yeah. Let's finish by talking about poo.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Poo and cheese and beer, actually, because the Guardian has an interesting story. They all come together. According to The Guardian, sophisticated ancient feces shows that human enjoyed beer and blue cheese 2,700 years ago, apparently. So salt miners in the Austrian Alps had a balanced diet, according to scientists, during the Bronze and Iron Age. And yes, these scientists have analysed their feces or whatever and discovered that they intentionally fermented foods and alcohol foods and liquids and things to create beer and cheese and things. So, but what I want to know is, is there some way you could then take this feces and sort of use some kind of DNA analysis to reconstruct it, and we'd actually see the kind of cheese and beer they ate and drank then?
Yeah, because there must be a market for it.
Well, I would think so. Absolutely, the oldest ever. You know, just even curiosity value.
Yeah.
I mean, whether you'd want to eat something that had been created from feces, I don't know. But certainly, as I say, the fact that this is the very first that's ever been identified anyway, I think would be fascinating, wouldn't
Absolutely.
It?
Simon, thank you very much
thank
indeed.
You.
That was Simon Brook, and this is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and it's time to talk business with Tola Onanuga, who's the weekend business editor at Insider. Welcome, Tola.
Morning.
So we've seen here in Britain, the port of Felixstowe has been having to turn ships away. There's just no space anymore. Well, in America, Joe Biden's announced major measures at ports there to battle supply chain woes. What's going to happen?
Yes, that's right. So what we've been seeing is, a huge amount of queues at key ports across the US. So this includes the port of Los Angeles. So in an effort to try and combat this issue, Biden has announced that the port of Los Angeles and other ports will be extending their operating hours. They'll be operating around the clock. And in addition, large companies, including the likes of Walmart, UPS and FedEx, will be also expanding their working hours to try and just tackle this huge backlog of goods and global supply chains that just are needed to really get the country moving again.
And that big backlog, I mean, is that COVID related? What's the reason for it?
Yes, so it's a combination of factors. We're seeing a labour shortage, which is very enduring across the US at the moment. And also, it's just a case of basic supply and demand. Like, demand is actually surging at the moment. This is because, sort of, as the pandemic becomes under control in some areas, more people are trying to get goods. And also because the holiday season is rapidly approaching. And so more people are looking to, buy goods and, you know, just get a head start on their shopping plans. And so we're just seeing this surge in demand at the moment.
I mean, here in Britain, everybody's very worried about Christmas not happening. I'm finding it hard to get my head around the fact that it can't happen just because we don't have a specific kind of bird on the table.
Yes, exactly. And I think in the US as well, like we are seeing the same kinds of concerns. And also it isn't just about kind of, you know, Christmas shopping. It's also about just critical goods that people do need to go about their everyday lives. People are being affected by that type of crisis as well.
Let's look at this Reuters exclusive from Facebook.
Yeah. Okay. So Facebook, as you know, has been in the news a lot recently. It's had various whistleblowers speaking out about the inner workings of the company, and in particular, their content moderation practices. So now Facebook has decided that it's going to widen the group of people who are given protection against harassment and bullying, and this will include journalists and activists. So in addition, the company is also going to ban other types of attacks that are aimed at public figures. So this will again include this group. And this is a part of an effort to just better protect marginalised groups. So this will include women, people of colour, and other groups that are just routinely attacked by trolls, essentially, on Facebook.
I wonder how they'll police that. Let's go on to the WHO. They say global COVID deaths have fallen to the lowest level in a year. That's good news.
Yes, definitely good news. So last week, they recorded 50,000 deaths, which, as you say, is the lowest level in almost a year. And this is true in every region except Europe. So there is great news there, but there is also a lot of bad news. And the bad news is that there is still a large vaccine gap, with developing countries typically receiving far less than other countries. So in fact, there are 56 countries who did not reach the World Health Organization's goal of vaccinating 10% of their populations by the end of September. And this is bad news because there is a big worry that the low vaccination rates could fuel the mutation of vaccine resistant COVID variants. And that remains a big worry for all countries.
Finally, let's have a look at a statement from the IMF.
Yes. So this is related
again to coronavirus and global supply chain. So it brings all your stories nicely together.
Yes, exactly. So there's a big gulf between the rich and the poor at the moment. And this is according to reports by the IMF. And this has been picked up by several newspapers. So perhaps it's no surprise that the pandemic is playing a significant role in this divide. The overall growth rates will remain around 6% this year, which is a historically high level. But unfortunately, the big divide represents a vast separation between the fortunes of the rich and the poor across developing countries. And again, this is something that it doesn't just matter for developing countries. This is essential to the global economy as a whole. So it's in everyone's interest to try and tackle these issues, not just leave it to developing countries themselves.
Absolutely. But no particular solution put in there.
No, I mean, the main issue that is driving this is worldwide poverty. Poverty has gone up during the pandemic. Also, we're seeing things like unmanageable debt is rising, and again, no surprise, but employment has fallen around the world, and this is particularly true for women. And we're seeing many of the gains that have been made in previous years are now being reversed because of the pandemic.
Tola, thank you very much for joining us. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Well, finally, it's time for the next instalment of our countdown of Monocle 24's top moments. This one is from a conversation we had with cookery icon Martha Stewart. Monocle's Marcus Hippie spoke to her in 2014 and started off by asking what she'd choose if forced to pick a last meal.
If I were to have a last meal, which I am not planning on having anytime soon, by the way, I would definitely include a wonderful sushi by Weizu-san of Karuma Sushi. And I've been eating Weizu-san's food for 19 years, and he was on 56th Street before that. So I've been going a long time.
And what do you think? What is so special about what he does?
It's all about the fish and about his lack of tolerance for inferiority. He is a perfectionist of the first order. And my daughter and I used to be able to eat a wardrobe of sushi. We would go, instead of going for clothes, we would go for sushi. Then when he refused one day to give my daughter extra rice.
Why?
Well, because he doesn't do that. She got upset because she was very hungry. So she didn't want to keep going to him, but she understands about his sushi.
How often do you find time to go to his restaurant?
Whenever I have enough money. It's all about the money. It's very expensive.
Is it really?
Hideously expensive. I don't want to say that in front of him.
Did becoming successful change the way you eat or ate?
No, I've always eaten the same way. And I will find, if I want to eat someplace and it's expensive, I find the way to go. There are ways to get to places. And I found that out early on. There's always a boy or a man that would take me to Masa or one of those great places who also loved good food.
That's amazing. It's important to find the right people. I'm meeting you at one of your studio kitchens. Would this be the place where you would like to have your last meal?
We're here? No. I don't want to have my last meal in my workplace. I want to have it in my most beautiful house in Maine. And I want Wei Zusan cooking there. And I want the champagne maker there too. Do we have P2? That's a really nice champagne. And the sake is very good sake.
And what kind of a room, where exactly would it be at your home where this meal would take place?
Oh, I have a beautiful, beautiful dining room that has the sun rises in the east, sets in the west, and windows on three sides, and a great big raging fire in the fireplace. It's beautiful. That's a great place to have a last meal. It's heavenly.
And then moving on to the next dish, it's not actually on the table anymore, but I saw you. I was wondering why no one has told me that you can do that with a potato.
Isn't it funny?
Yeah. Just smashing it that way.
See how, because potatoes are total fiber inside. And you know when you cut into a baked potato, it's usually hard as a rock, even when it's cooked, you open it up and it's like two slabs. And it's not tasty that way when you bash it like that. And I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine. We went to his farm to learn all about the harvest of potatoes. And he baked me a potato, and it was like eating the best thing ever cooked that way.
So is that the reason why you chose it? Because it was something...
Cute? Oh, no, it's cute, but it's also delicious with caviar and creme fraiche. I mean, there's nothing more filling or more delicious than that. Especially if you have an unlimited source of caviar for your last supper.
And what happens then after that potato and caviar?
Look at that, Kevin. He's like very happy with his potato. That's our birthday potato.
It's amazing.
Yeah, you can have that.
When you think of all your travels around the world,
and I like that very much.
When you think of the most memorable experiences with food, can you name one or two?
You always remember like the best date you had with the best meal. And that was at Lutèce, actually, the old Lutèce in New York. And that was a very fun meal and a very fun date and a very fun evening. We had duck. I remember having the most delicious duck, bigarade, with dark cherries. And I think something lemon, like a lemon souffle for dessert. It was delicious.
And I take it it was a good date because
yeah,
you remember
it. It was a very good date. Yeah, that was a very good date. That was a fun date.
When you travel around the world, what kind of restaurants do you like? Are there some characteristics to places?
Well, we look really hard for restaurants, and we do a lot of thinking about it before we go to a city. And we have quite a network of friends and colleagues all over the place that help us find the good places to eat. And yet, not every time is successful.
Can you give me recent examples, when you actually would have found something or seen something that would have been particularly inspirational?
Yeah, there's a little bakery on 10th Street called Chickalicious. She makes delicious pastries. So I went down to visit her, and we got very inspired. I wanted to see how she made her, you know, there's a thing called the cronut now, a big rage of cronut from Dominique Ancel. Well, his is horizontal. Hers uses a puff pastry in a vertical ring. And you find these things out just by watching and looking. She doesn't tell you that.
Can you name people you would have learned something from recently in terms of, say, baking, cooking, food?
Oh, yeah, well, the baker at Chicalicious, for one, from Dominique Ancel, another, from there's a very fine Japanese chef called Chef Abe at N Brasserie. That's another place in New York for Japanese cooked food that is delicious. And he makes amazing collars of fish and bones of fish that I love. I like things like bones and collars.
That was Martha Stewart speaking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie. And we'll continue celebrating 10 years of Monocle 24 later today at our Media Summit here in London, where we'll be broadcasting live on the Monocle Daily at 1800 London time. And do check our website. There might be a few tickets left if you're in London. Come and meet us. That's all for today's programme. Thanks to producers Daniel Bache, Paige Reynolds and Charlie Filmer-Court, researcher Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and our studio manager Sam Impey. More music on the way after the news, and of course The Briefing is live at midday in London, and The Globalist returns at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.